So the presentation then that I'm going to touch on is primarily, I'm going to focus on three major things: the origins of our program and how it evolved, our next generation system that we're building on campus for podcasting, as well as the OpenCast community and project, give you an explanation as to what that is. I think a lot of you have heard about our community and are interested to know more of the details about it. And I just wanted to preface this by saying, I'm going to throw around the word podcast. I know that many of us in the room use that word. When we say podcast, we primarily mean capturing audio and video and distributing that either through video on demand, on a download, via a website, or through streaming. So I get confused with that word, so if any of you were wondering. So I'm going to first touch on the origins of our program called Webcast.Berkeley. So in 1995, a computer science professor named Larry Rowe started to stream his courses using Real Media. He just thought it was just a pet project, and his students absolutely loved it. And so that was a couple years later, he realized that, wow, I have something here. My students are clamoring they want more and more of this. So he handed over the streaming to the centralized campus so they can offer it as a service to the campus. So in 2001, we started Webcast.Berkeley. And essentially, Webcast.Berkeley provides, it basically records lectures and special events on campus and provides them to the world. Just in the last year, we captured over 86 courses, and we have 134 events. Events comprise of notable speakers like Stephen Hawking, President Carter, and so forth. And what's unique about our organization is that when Larry Rowe started it, he never put authentication around the media, just simply because he never thought about it. And it was too difficult. And so we just sort of followed that tradition, and we're open. Everything we capture, we offer to the public for free. In 2006, we were one of the first schools to have an iTunes U site. I don't know if everyone in the room is familiar with iTunes U. It's an Apple portal, essentially, for higher education media. So you can find university content from all over the, well, now, soon, from all over the world. For lectures and special events. For our iTunes instantiation, we have 5,000 tracks currently available, and we've had 4 million downloads within the last 2 years. So we have quite a lot of traffic. We also have just to share a point, iTunes U has really been a galvanizing force on our campus. For some reason, everyone knows about Apple. So before we were doing iTunes U, it was kind of this, you know, early adopter thing, and now that it's on iTunes U, there's a lot of professors and students that are a lot more excited about podcasting and the possibilities of it. So it's been really great for us. In September 2006, we had the first Google site of any university. I'm not really going to touch on this because primarily Google bought YouTube, and that's really their destination place for video. But we do still have a Google site. We don't really use it anymore. We're mainly focused on our YouTube site, which we launched last year. It has it's been an extraordinary success. We've had 13,700 subscribers, and that's growing every week, and 3.2 million views. So just to show you a trajectory of the popularity of our courses, around 2006 we started offering audio podcasts for free, so that any room that has the podcast infrastructure installed, they can just simply sign up and podcast. Before that, the departments that primarily were involved in Webcast.Berkeley was like computer science and the sciences, simply because for the video lectures, although we subsidized half of the cost, it's still expensive. So they didn't have the money to pay for the video podcasts. But since we installed this free audio podcast infrastructure, the amount of humanities courses has skyrocketed. And interestingly enough, on iTunes U, our humanities courses have been the most popular. We actually found that we found our philosophy course wedged between ESPN and BBC on the top 100 podcasts in iTunes U, and it just kind of blew our mind. So those are the interesting things that have sort of emerged from our grand experiment. As events go, this chart really indicates the growth of events. It's really been everyone on campus wants to capture their events now and share it out with the world. They set that aside in their budget, and it's just growing tremendously. Because we have so much growth, our students are basically knocking down the door, saying, begging their teachers, "I want your course podcast," because from the students' perspective, this saves them a lot of time, and it's a great study resource. And so our events and our courses have just been skyrocketing, and we thought, well, we need more rooms that have a podcast infrastructure, and our current system just cannot scale. We've had a system in place for 7 years, and although it's gotten us really far, it's been a painful ride to a certain degree, and we're ready to redo our system and have a more scalable system. Because of the demand, we're going to have 70 plus capable rooms by 2011, and that translates into 1,000 plus undergraduate courses that have the potential to be podcast. Obviously, we have an approval-only policy, so the faculty have to approve to participate. But they could potentially even a quarter of 1,000 courses is quite a lot. So we're preparing ourselves for the onslaught. So as I mentioned, our current system's a patchwork quilt of technologies. We particularly are not fond of Reel. And it was a legacy decision that was really smart at the time, but it's very difficult to... our number one request, both from the public and our students, is please get rid of Reel. And we never thought about different media formats at the time. We never thought about a flexible system. So we basically have a very inflexible system, and so the idea is to get rid of the dinosaur in our midst. And so the benefit of that, though, is we have 7 years of experience in this field. We've done a lot of software development, a lot of AV work around podcasting. And so we felt like, should we build or buy? Should we just buy something off the shelf, or should we build it ourselves? And it was a hard decision to make. And frankly, it's quite a daunting decision to make. There's just a lot of information out there. But we felt like we had 7 years of experience, and there were a lot of interesting emerging technologies out there, like Podcast Producer. So we felt like we could do both. We could both build it and take advantage of commercial software that's already available. And as I said, the proprietary systems we either find were expensive, inflexible, or they're too much time to pilot. There's a lot of those systems out there, and really to understand their limitations and their benefits, you really have to run them through a full semester and really understand their limitations. And we simply don't have the resources to experiment with that. And we felt like we had, I don't know if any of you are familiar with Sakai, but it's this open source initiative, learning management system. And so that's what we happen to have on our campus. And we've solved a lot of the issues of integrating with integration services on our campus, so we felt like Sakai is the perfect conduit to access those services for our new application. So we wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel to access our registry or user directory and authentication and so forth. So we felt like, wow, we have Sakai. We really can leverage that as a centralized service, because putting Sakai in our campus was very challenging, to be able to hook that up to our student information systems and so forth. Quality of service issues. Our old system basically would break down and never tell us it broke down. So that was problematic at times. It caused for excitement, but we don't like to be an excitable bunch, folks. So the major piece, as I noted, we're really scaling this at UC Berkeley. We have about, correct me if I'm wrong, Berkeley people in the audience, but I think we have about 30,000 undergraduate students, just a lot of people. And so, and we have a lot of faculty, and that we're going to have podcasting in all these general assignment classrooms. We're making that investment. We want to make sure that the faculty know that it exists and that they can take advantage of it. So the idea is that one of our number one priorities with the new system is really to lower the barrier of participation. So when a faculty basically logs into their learning management system, they're presented with a form that says, hey, you're teaching these two classes and they happen to be in podcast-enabled rooms. Would you like to participate? So they don't have to, we don't have to run around campus with an approval form trying to chase after faculty, and it's just a much more scalable way to approach this. So basically participation management decreases the overhead for communication and room scheduling and policy enforcement. Since we've been in this for a long time, there are certain rules that we want to abide by, like the fact that a faculty member, we can't capture their course unless all of them approve. And in the past, it's been an imperfect process, but with our new system, that helps. Also emailing. There's hundreds of people that we would need to email to let them know about our system, and this and our new system just simply takes care of it itself. And another really neat part of our participation management component is it tracks the instructor's responses, so that if you find through time that a specific department isn't interested in podcasting, only a few people are, you can target that department and maybe engage with them from an instructional technology standpoint and say, you know, this is a really great resource. Is there ways that we can help you come on board? And also, it's a good way to show your sponsors, whoever's allowing you to put this infrastructure into your campus, the rate of growth and participation. So it's a really good statistical resource. So here's an example of what a faculty member would see when they log on to their site. They'd be presented with a form like this, where they would just simply express whether they'd want to capture audio. We also happen to have screencasts in the room. All our audio podcast room now will have screencasting, which means that whatever's happening on the projector or the digital projector, it'll all be captured on the podcast. So whatever PowerPoint they're doing would be captured with the audio podcast, and that's all for free. There's no need to have someone in the classroom actually doing that work. Our video classrooms, we have about 7 of them, and it basically you need 2 manned cameras in the room. Primarily, we use students, but it's still very expensive, and the coordination effort of having the students show up on time and capture this stuff properly can be challenging. So we kind of felt like with the rooms that we're going to expand, we're going to take away the video part and just have them be screencasting and audio only. From our student and faculty standpoint, they're okay with that. It's not so important for them to see a talking head as well. So here's an example of our participation management component. On a high-level view, it's sitting within our learning management system. Just an up-close view. So all of this information is being automatically gathered from our student information system. So all the changes of classes and who comes into a class, who changes classes, what instructor was teaching that class, on a day-to-day level, that's all being synced. So before this, we have a course manager who is basically a human computer that would look at 6 different subsystems and figure out, oh, this person moved from this location, now I need to contact them, I need to let this person know who signed up that they no longer can participate. All that's being taken care of by our system. So that was actually an enormous amount of work that's all being automated. And as you can see, there's a yes response, and they wanted to do audio and screencast. And as I touched on before, there's the response status, so you can actually see who responded, who said no, who's undecided, and who did you invite that just simply didn't respond. And it's interesting to see the trends through time, how that changes. Invitation status, as everyone here may have experienced at their campus, different courses come online, courses change, and if somebody needs an invitation that hadn't received one, it keeps track of all of that. So if a new instructor is in a course, it'll let you know that somebody else needs an invitation. Also, publication status. We actually have to pay for video. The video rooms, you actually have to pay a certain amount of money to capture your course. So we have a little paycheck box to ensure that it's been paid before we actually go out and capture. So there's these business rules that are expressed within our UI that allow us to be able to capture this stuff accordingly. So in terms of capture, we feel like one of the successes at Berkeley is that we don't disrupt the faculty's lecture style. They simply need to put a mic on their lapel, and the course is automatically captured. So they don't have to press anything, they just simply talk. And the rooms that they generally lecture in have sound reinforcement anyway, so they have to wear one of these mics. So that's really all there is to it. Because of that, though, we have to deal with the trim times ourselves, because it is public, all the content that we create. So someone actually has to review that and trim each of the lectures. We are considering in the future potentially putting that responsibility on back to the professors, but that's something that we're considering in terms of scalability. And our new system basically allows real-time monitoring of the processes from capture to delivery. So if anything fails at any point, it'll let us know immediately, which is great, so that we can go out and be proactive in the classroom in case an audio feed is not active or we can't see any video. Our system will immediately tell us if something fails or something was successful. And as you can see here, all the various inputs, like the camera, the document camera, all of that stuff can be piped into our little device. We happen to have a Mac Mini here because we use Podcast Producer, but one of the wonderful things that could potentially come out of a joint project is you may not need Mac Mini. You could have potentially different infrastructure to capture this stuff. And here's an example of our dashboard, the real-time monitoring mechanism that I was talking about. But this is a snapshot of it about 3 weeks ago in the midst of alpha development. So all those programmers out there might be able to relate to the rawness of the UI. It's not quite ready for prime time, but this is just an example to illustrate the feedback we get between what's being captured in the classroom and what's being sent to us message-wise to our centralized server. We know exactly what's happening at all points of time. But as you can see, we don't live in a perfect world. Captures fail, and it'll tell us. And then when all things fall apart, we'll know immediately. We'll receive an email as well as see it on the dashboard. So all the people that need to know immediately, so that someone can go out there and fix things. So as distribution goes, as I mentioned before, we're distributing to three distinctive distribution channels, YouTube, webcast.berkeley.edu, which is our local distribution channel. We've had webcast.berkeley.edu since day one, and actually that's the channel that the students primarily go to access their content, interestingly enough. But we felt like bringing our content to YouTube also made a lot of sense, because that's the destination for video on the web. So, you know, students are there anyway. We might as well offer them the content that they have at their university and iTunes U. Although it's really garnered a lot of support at the university and has given us a lot of attention, to distribute to YouTube and iTunes U is actually quite intensive production-wise. You have to have different types of metadata. You have to prepare it for those specific channels. And currently, that's all done manually. We actually don't have an automated process currently for doing the branding piece for our courses on these distribution channels. So things like a watermark or knowing or intro and outro that say, hey, this is from UC Berkeley, once they download it from iTunes U, it doesn't really provide, there's no identity currently, and our new system's going to do branding automatically. And so all that stuff is going to be automated. So branding and audio and video, that's all automated now. Our intros and outros are going to be, the introduction and the end of the video and audio are going to be done via text-to-speech as well as dynamically created slides for title slides and so forth. So that's so we don't have to touch that from a production standpoint. And all that data is going to be generated from our registrar, so we don't have to actually hand-enter anything in. It's all being automated. And from a distribution standpoint, we don't have to, I don't know if anyone has distributed to YouTube yet, but you actually have to create these customized XML exports. And we don't, our system's going to be doing all of that for us. And I sort of touched on this before. Right now, we're only providing media in Reel, and in the future, we're going to also provide it video on demand with HD64, so that people can just download it and watch it at their leisure on their computer without a connection. You know, it seems very, very basic, but that's just something that we haven't provided yet because of antiquated systems. And the most important thing is, by us, we just happen to be sort of at the forefront of distribution channels on campus. So we have, there's a lot of people on campus doing video, like public affairs, for instance, that's very much the organization that wants to engage with the public about the university. So we happen to be the owners of the gateway of these major distribution channels, and we want to be able to pull people in and make them partners and use our infrastructure for their own purposes. So here's just a quick example of what our interface would look like. You can change the time, the location, you can provide custom metadata, you can automate a recording or do it manually. I can touch on this later if anyone wants me to do a little demo of it. And so the idea is that we have this, right now we built a system for UC Berkeley, a next generation system. And we always had in the back of our head, wouldn't it be nice if this wasn't just some boutique system that we created that no one cared about? It would be nice if we had more people engaged so that what we generate, we can't simply solve every single problem out there. I mean, if any of you have been doing this for a while, you know that there's just 100 different issues, and it's just impossible to have your campus deal with every single one of them, like archiving, like there's different elements of distribution. Captioning are just three of them that are just really, really big problems. And so the idea is that we built these high-level services called the framework services in our application. And right now they talk to Sakai, but they're actually loosely coupled with Sakai. So theoretically, you could create an implementation that would integrate with Moodle. And so these framework services that we created, we simply created ourselves. And we tried to think, what would another university want? But we're not kidding ourselves with being that smart that we could actually figure that all out, because universities want very different things. But the idea would be potentially to discuss with other universities what kind of services would be common across different applications, and what could we potentially share, so that any innovations that happen within this domain, we could potentially build stuff that could commonly engage with other frameworks. So for example, like authentication and authorization, user directory services, and registrar information are all basically talking to Sakai, but they could be talking to something else. It's just an implementation detail. And you know, obviously Moodle and Sakai are only a few of the learning management systems out there. It'd just be a matter, if you want to adopt this on campus, creating an implementation of the framework services for your campus. And as you can see here, we have this tasker and scheduler concept that I'm not really going to get into in much detail, but we'll have an opportunity on Thursday and Friday to discuss this more. But there's this component of our system that basically talks to podcast producer, but from the get-go, we realized we want to treat podcast producer as a black box. We don't want to, although we like podcast producer, you never know within a year or two or 10 whether they change the product, move in different directions, or you're really in need of a specific feature that it doesn't offer and it becomes a deal breaker on your campus. So we basically are using the iCalendar specification and REST calls to be able to decouple from podcast producer to a certain degree. And the idea is that we could potentially swap in or use podcast producer along with some other system. We've talked to ETH Zurich, who some of you may be familiar with, and you'll likely learn more about their system if you're participating in the Thursday and Friday meetings. And it's very much, to a certain degree, like podcast producer infrastructure-wise, and it would be a great example of testing it out, some kind of abstract implementation, running our system on top of Replay versus podcast producer. And, you know, there could be other systems out there as well. As you know, there's just a lot out there that you can take advantage of. And people might have their own infrastructure already in place or their own podcast producer on their campus, but may want to take advantage of the tools that we create. So it's our hope is that these kind of services would be flexible enough that you wouldn't have to adopt this monolithic system in order to adopt something like this on your campus. It could be potentially very lightweight for you. But I just want to emphasize that Webcast.Berkeley's next generation system is not the OpenCast system. It could be potentially a cornerstone of the OpenCast system. It could be a fundamental building block. It could potentially not be a part of the system at all. But we've done a lot of work creating our next generation system, and we're hoping that it could have a role within the OpenCast project. But and I'll talk about the OpenCast project briefly, but when people think of Berkeley, they think, oh, they're providing the OpenCast software, and I'll explain that in a little more detail. So we have this OpenCast project planning grant that was provided by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. They basically provided a generous grant to have planning activities like us going to Oxford and be able to invite a bunch of people to talk about the various requirements and best practices in this domain. Because we realized that although UC Berkeley thinks that they do things well, we created this email listserv, OpenCast, and from that alone we realized, wow, people have been doing this forever and they're really smart and there's a lot we didn't consider. So if there is common services that we would generate, we need to talk to a lot of different people and really gather the requirements across a lot of universities. UC Berkeley happens to be a very centralized university. Our AV infrastructure, our podcasting, and everything's under one umbrella. But places like, I was talking to a gentleman from Oxford at the while we were sipping some tea, and he said that everything's very decentralized here. So we also recognize, and that's actually something that could also benefit our campus, a very much a system that also supports a very decentralized administration. So that's something that we immediately recognize as something that's missing from our application that could apply to others and also benefit us in the future. So why OpenCast? From a high level, this is kind of our, high hopes, from an institution point of view, we really want to enable people to be able to make the right choices about the infrastructure and the software that they purchase or build or whatnot for audio and video, capturing and disseminating that content. When we tried to make a decision on our own, it was pretty overwhelming. There wasn't a really cohesive information out there as to what people need to know if they want to start a podcast program at their campus. And our hopes through this planning grant would be to provide that information to folks through the input taken from the people in this room. So the faculty, we want them to be able to use this technology and be excited about it, but also for it not to get in the way. So the reason why we've been so popular at our campus is the faculty don't need to do anything. And at least at Berkeley, that is the case, that they're interested in it, but they really don't want to change their teaching style or need to worry about it. And so we really feel like that's a really good principle to have approaching this. And students, I think they want more, and they want to be able to have tools that shape this media in more meaningful ways. We're so focused on the infrastructure now, which I think is really important, but what's equally, if not more important, is actually taking the media that our infrastructure generates and create really interesting, different forms of learning from that. And so, for example, we have one of our partners, Columbia University, has built a lot of pedagogically relevant tools around video and audio, and they may be interested in building more learning-oriented tools around the media that our system would generate. And basically everyone, we generate a lot of content and offer to the world, and we wish that other people did it. It's not like the overdriving force. You could belong to OpenCast and have all your content behind walls. But one of the ideas about being a part of the OpenCast community and project is that hopefully with this free infrastructure and with the best practices, when you generate content, you would be able to potentially offer some of that for free to the world. So also, as I touched on open source and open content, it's sort of the marriage of the two. We want to create this open source infrastructure that also generates open content. We're part of OCW, the MIT movement for open courseware, and we really want to be able to lower the cost of creating a scalable system. There's a lot of schools out there that this is just not, they just simply can't afford an infrastructure for this kind of content. We've a dream of ours is potentially, you know, cloud services, or there's no reason why 100 different schools would need to have duplicate infrastructure for video. You could have a lot of schools be using the same infrastructure. So there's just interesting ways in which we could collaborate. And also opening the door to the larger amount of arts and humanities and science information. Even the information behind closed walls, maybe there could be some kind of commons that universities could share their content if they're not really comfortable with the whole copyright issue behind walls. So it's just a lot of different ways in which we could potentially share content. So some of the drivers is, as I touched on, is doing more. How can we do it better and for less? We've been doing this for a long time, and we constantly ask ourselves, how do we do this more cheaply? How can people access this fantastic content? Through YouTube and iTunes U, we've really been able to expand this to a wider audience. But for example, like talking to Bjorn Hassler from Cambridge, there's a whole other contingent of people that don't even have access to the internet. So there's this whole other level of accessibility that we haven't even considered. Now, how can we make the context and experience around the content richer? A podcast is wonderful, you can look at it, but how do you make it more meaningful to the student? What can they do with it once it's been captured that really allows them to learn better? And how can we leverage existing innovation and delivery platforms? I already talked to like five people during the previous break, and they're all doing this on their campus. So how do we get this energy and move it towards some common goal and not try to reinvent everything that everybody's doing? So basically, there's the community that we like to talk about. It's essentially a means to share information. We have over 215 distinct organizations that are on our email listserv. And the email listserv is basically for anyone to just pose a question. It could be about podcast producer. It could be about AV infrastructure. It could be about why would one want a podcast, or do you need to worry about copyright material? I mean, it really covers everything. And there's 350 individual participants on that list. It's really wonderful because whenever I have a question, I just send it out to the list and I get 10 answers from all over the world. And before, I used to just like go through Google and probably unsuccessfully find information. So this is just a very great resource. From a project standpoint, right now we're gathering user requirements. On Thursday and Friday, we're going to have working group meetings with a smaller subset of this group in here, really capturing what are your workflows on your campus, what are the roles on your campus, and what are the requirements. We want to understand where we overlap and where we totally go in separate directions, and if there's that sweet spot where we all can collaborate and really benefit from each other's work. So in terms of the project work plan, Apple actually was very generous and granted us a sum of money to host a conference at Cupertino in their offices, which was very, very early on when we just started playing with Podcast Producer, but we had this intention to engage more universities. And so we had about 8 or 9 universities attend that, and it was although it was very preliminary, we had, from that meeting, we discovered, okay, we're not just doing this in a closet and we're not out of our minds. There's actually a lot of overlap here. A lot of people have similar needs to us. So we were a little nervous, we were putting a lot of effort into this, and we were like, well, what if nobody cares? And it seemed like, well, everybody needs stuff like this. But we also realized that, you know, Berkeley's specific in its own ways, and there would have to be something that's more generalized for the entire community. So just recently we had our first group meeting at Berkeley, and there's actually some people in the audience that attended that, and this meeting will be a variation of that. And so we're really going to be asking you to get your hands dirty, and it's going to be a very busy and hopefully a fun time. And so obviously our meeting at Oxford this week, and the idea is that by late September we'll be able to make a decision whether we want to move forward with the collaborative project, software project, and that could involve applying for a grant. The folks that had provided us money for the planning grant, we feel would be interested in providing money for a software grant. It just depends on who's involved and if we want to go that direction. We may find that we want to do this more informally than formally. And we're also going to provide documentation. All the information that we're gathering, we're posting to our blog, and we're also going to have a more formal document that's provided March 2009. So, and here's just an example of some of the workshop contributors that have been participants in the workshops that we've held. And so the idea is that we want to provide a roadmap, requirements, funding, all those fun things that you need to really kickstart a project. And we feel like we want to be able to share and document best practices as a community. And for any additional information, feel free to go to our blog, and you can also subscribe to our email list. They're both pretty informational. It's a little confusing because our email list is active and our blog's active, and sometimes they have different content, so you might want to subscribe to both. Just check it out. And I don't know, I probably went over, but is anyone?
That's fine. I mean,
yeah.
That's great.
Okay.
I mean, we've got built in a little bit of time for questions and answers after quite a few of the sessions today. So it's a great opportunity, you know, just to maybe ask a few questions about Adam and the Berkeley project. Any questions out in the audience? Chris, can you just say who you are and where you're from?
I'm Chris Bedigan. University of Oxford.
Okay.
Here in Portland. I'm interested in the resourcing issue. So you mentioned lots of people who are working today. Are these that are working full time on this project, and that's your team? Just tell me a bit about the resources behind it.
So currently, I'm the project manager for this application, the system that we're replacing on our campus. It's an enterprise level system. So in terms of, we really view it as that system for the entire campus, and it's also a new enterprise layer in terms of media, distribution, and processing. So we're hopefully going to provide this layer to the entire campus. So I'm managing that, and Josh is the lead architect on that. We kind of view this is a big project, this one piece, and then we'll probably have subsequent smaller projects that are associated with working on the software and the infrastructure. Sergio is also focusing on the podcast producer side of things. So there's probably going to be, we're a software development group, at least the folks that I just pointed out. So there'll probably be distinct projects that'll happen at specific times, but we're not dedicated to it. Right now we're dedicated to it full time, but likely in the future there'll be more of a mix of other things that we'll need to focus on. Ben is primarily focused on video production and also managing the distribution side of things. So he really goes and engages with the faculty out in the classroom and lets them know about our services, as well as engages with clients who want to pay for events to be captured. So he does that. He does that full time. He basically runs the program. And Judy's been assigned as a designer for the project, but as with the other software folks, she could be working on another design project sometime in the future. It just depends on how we allocate resources.
Right. Just to provide a little additional context, our organization, ETS, is comprising about 55 full-time staff. And the webcast program, which is what the the next generation system is going to support, is kind of touching a lot of different people within that group. There's probably eight or nine people working full time just on the webcast side of things, whether program production, development, kind of areas, and other people kind of support.
There's some aspect of it in the cost recovery involved in recapture, both on the event side and the course side. So the event side, it's a pure cost recovery. On the course side, it's a cost share with about half of the cost being covered by central campus funding and the other half by the departments.
It's also interesting because we do have, there's a redundancy as well. Like we'll have colleges or departments that have some IT folks as well and some AV folks. So the distributed administration could even potentially work on our campus to a degree, although a lot of the stuff is centralized under our umbrella. But there is some redundancy in place.
Any other questions?
Wendy Horman from the University of Oxford Computing Services. I was interested in your classroom management system, which I think would be is something we struggle with here because of the decentralized nature of the institution. Have you open sourced that system?
How do we support it?
How do you open source the system? Because it looked very useful.
I'm assuming you're talking about our podcast system, not the Sakai system, right?
No, I was talking specifically just about the management of the resources. Who's in what lecture room? When is this lecture room available?
Oh yeah. There's a scheduler that we interface with to a certain degree, and she basically works with the departments to put specific people. If I'm understanding your question.
At one point you said this used to be done by a human and now it's automated. I'm interested in the automated systems.
So how do we open source that and manage that? That would hopefully be something that we would discuss under the umbrella of OpenCast.
Technically it is all open source right now in that it is in an open subversion in Sakai, but it's not documented well or yet. So if you wanted to take it and play with it, you probably should wait until we're done QAing it. You can do that.
Mira is much more forthcoming than I was. I was kind of, it really isn't ready for prime time. We're scrambling to get it launched in fall.
Okay.